This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, I'm Simon Mayo. Welcome to another Film Reviews podcast. In a moment, Mark's thoughts on the latest box office releases and the top 10. First, an interview with indie film god John Sayles. He came in to talk about his latest movie, Honey Dripper.
Honey Dripper takes place in a little cotton-picking crossroads town of Harmony, Alabama in 1950. Danny Glover plays the proprietor of the Honey Dripper Lounge, who's a boogie-woogie piano player, and he's about to lose his club unless he has one big Saturday night and he starts building houses of cards. And it's kind of about the roots of rock and roll and what it was like to live in the Deep South in 1950.
And recreating the Deep South of 1950, how did you set about that?
You look for places that all the new stuff is built about two blocks away from the old stuff. So we actually shot in Greenville in Georgiana, Alabama. Georgiana is the town that Hank Williams grew up in. And the main street hasn't actually changed that much since then. It's still got major railroad tracks going through it instead of much of a road. And most of the new stuff is about two blocks away. So very often you just change some awnings and some signs and you're back in the South of 1950.
You mentioned right at the beginning there, talk about the cotton picking South, which for a lot of people in this country just is like a phrase, you know.
Dashnaggit.
Exactly. That's what it is. But here, this is real. Presumably, you needed to find somewhere where the cotton was indeed high.
Yeah, actually, it's not high
was
anymore.
That CGI?
I wish it had been. We tried to raise money for the movie for a full year with Danny Glover attached and couldn't. And then the cotton was all picked. And so we had to wait a whole nother year to make the movie once we got the money. CGI can do a lot of things, but it can't put all those little cotton balls on the plants. No, we actually went to an area where they still grow cotton. It's not the king of the economy the way it used to be. And since about the early 60s, it's been harvested by machine. So we were in the rare situation of having to have a seminar on cotton picking in Alabama for our younger extras.
That's great. How do most people, at the time where your movie opens, how do most people hear music?
Well, if they're poor, they go to the one sharecropper shack in the area that gets electricity because rural electrification had just really hit rural Alabama, and they listen to the radio and they hear some. Most people, however, if they're poor, they either make it themselves. The movie opens with a kid playing a diddly bow, which is a wire taken off a broom, stretched really tight, and you bottleneck on that. Or they go to the revival tent and hear gospel music, mostly without instruments, mostly just the human voice. Or they go to a roadhouse. And if that roadhouse pays their power bill, they have a jukebox. And if it doesn't, like the Honey Dripper Lounge, they have live music.
And explain the Honey Dripper Lounge, giving your movie the
Honey Dripper. If you listen to blues songs and you hear Jelly Roll a lot, Honey Dripper is the male equivalent of a Jelly Roll. And so, and it's actually a fairly common name for juke joints in the South. We passed one every day on the way to work when we were shooting a movie in northern Florida, and it just seemed like a great name for a movie.
So you mentioned Danny Glover. Explain Gary Clark Jr.'s character and the impact that he has, and then we'll talk to bring Mark in.
Yeah, Gary Clark Jr. plays a young guy named Sonny Blake who wanders into town with a guitar case in hand, and it's 1950, and he's looking for work, and Danny's playing a guy who's never allowed a guitar player under his roof, doesn't like them on principle, had a
good was principle.
And murdered one in a stupid fight when he was a young man, and so he's kind of haunted by this instrument. And he hires this kid to pretend to be another player, but then when he opens the guitar case, there's no hole in the guitar, and it has wires sticking out of it, and he thinks this kid is a nutcase. And and we're in big trouble now. He's kind of the Johnny Appleseed of the electric guitar. He's wandering around, hopping on boxcars and just kind of spreading this new gospel of a new kind of music that nobody calls rock and roll.
When we were talking about the U2 3D movie in our middle hour, Mark said that he believes that the peak of music's achievement was Skiffle.
You have to contextualize this, because the American, Skiffle actually comes from America and house parties, and then Skiffle is a very specifically British term. It was brought back here by Ken Collier after going and playing with jug bands and then coming back and calling it Skiffle. But it's essentially what you're talking about with the diddly bow, and it's with T-Chess bass and jug band music.
Yeah, we call it jug band or hokum music.
And I think that's absolutely right.
And so as someone who believes this to be the highest form of music attainable, what do you make of Honey Dripper?
Well, it's playing so much into all the areas that I love. I mean, obviously, I'm a big fan of John, so we have met before in Cannes, so there's absolutely no reason that you would remember that. Because I've been a film critic for 20 years, and there are some people whose work, every time it comes up, you think, I know I'm going to get... You know, we talked a little bit about Brian Cox being a presence. Whenever Brian Cox is in something, what you're going to get with John Sayles' movie. Firstly, you're going to get not single characters, dramas, but dramas in which people interconnect, which they're about the connections between people and about the connections between, in this case, between politics and religion and, civil rights and all that stuff. I mean, it nods towards Robert Johnson, it nods towards all those things that I find interesting, but it does it in a way that never feels like you're being hectored or lectured. Again, I think one of the things that people who know your work don't sometimes remember is that, you come from writing exploitation scripts as well. Mm-hmm. You've written your fair share of really good schlockers.
Piranha, Alligator, giant cockroach movies.
When I first started working at Time Out, I bought as a present for the editor who had given me the job a copy of the novelization of Piranha.
Yes, which had my name on it.
It did, that's why I
sued them for that.
Oh, no!
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I thought it because he's a huge John Sayles.
Well, because I didn't write the novelization, but it put my name on the cover.
I know. You just put your foot in it there, Mark. Yeah.
Well, I'm terribly sorry. Well, Jeff gave me the job anyway, so that was great. Yeah. So that's what you get. What you get is you get fully rounded characters. You get interaction between the characters in which what you see is a story playing out with all those people. You get the connection between the civil movement and the musical movement, and I think the other thing, and I think you would agree with this, that runs through all of your films is that you feel a genuine affection for those characters. And what happens more and more in modern cinema is that it's about people, that it's not only that the audience don't care about, you don't think the filmmaker cares about them either.
John?
Yeah, for me, I started as an actor, and one of the things that an actor always has to do is say, who can I be? Most people who are bad guys, who do bad things, don't think of themselves as that. They don't go home and say, oh, I'm a really awful person. What will I do that's awful tomorrow? They have their reasons for doing things. They justify what they're doing. And so as I write these characters, I try to see where they're coming from. And so that actor who comes to play that part has a little something to bake in, even if they do things that you don't admire. Danny Glover in Honey Dripper plays a guy who lies, cheats, and steals from his stepdaughter who has a heart condition, and you still like him and you're rooting for him at the end of the movie, and because you understand where he's coming from.
I was going to say, there's a scene in Passion Fish which has always stuck with me, in which characters sit around and talk about the way in which their lives have brought them to this particular point. And it's the classic example of a sequence in which if somebody said to you, how is the story progressing here? What's the narrative arc? Where it's going to? I don't know. It's a bunch of people sitting around talking. And yet, the narrative is always progressed by people revealing themselves through what's apparently very, very incidental conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the more incidental, the better. it's one of those things that if the audience feels like they're finding something out rather than being told something, always works a little bit better.
Do you think that there was a definable moment when all these different musical strands came together, whether it be R&B or whether it be jazz and country and blues, or is it the suggestion of the film that actually it's the creation of the electric guitar which made all this possible?
I think the electric guitar was just a catalyst for there was this little battle between the guitar and the piano that lasted 5 or 6 years, and at the end of it, the guitar was up there on the stage.
It has
and
a
the
few
piano.
Advantages, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's cheaper, it's more portable, and once you could plug it into the wall, it's louder than the piano. And then, you know, people like Ike Turner and Chuck Berry started playing the piano line and the honking saxophone line on that guitar. So I don't think it was one moment. I think there's stuff that was recorded in 1943 that you would have to call rock and roll. But I do think that there was a sea change, and that the musicians knew, the way they know before the audience does, everything's going to change. And if I don't jump aboard this new thing, I'm going to be left behind. And that's pretty much what happened to the people in that rhythm and blues era. They were like the people in Woody Allen's radio days, you know, really famous for about 5 years, and then not less famous, but pretty much unknown once rock and roll came in.
Often when we talk to directors and they tell us about their films, people are very frustrated because they're intrigued, they're fascinated, they try and go to the local cinema and they can't find it. What kind of distribution have you got for Honey Dripper Jam?
It's going to be opening May 9th in London, and then hopefully spreading from there like a benevolent disease.
But most of your films do get proper distribution. You are one of the, and it's interesting because now when you're more and more in a world in which horror, like you know, saw Rambo and it's going to open everywhere, in which those things are plugging up the multiple. You are one of the few people who has managed to completely do what you want to do on your own terms and still retain pretty widespread distribution. You are not by any means obscure.
Yeah, we get away with it somehow, or have so far. In 30 years, we've made 16 movies, which is, you know, not a bad average. You know, even the studio people, directors I know, don't make many more movies than that. And a lot of it is, it's going to be a year and a half of your life with the publicity that comes after it. And you don't want to end up at the end of a year and a half saying, oh, you should have seen my cut. Or if I'd only been able to cast that actor I wanted, it would have worked out. But, you know, and then the trade-off is you get less money and you have less money to advertise it. And the good thing is that now we actually get incredibly good, well-known actors who say yes to working for scale. Yeah. So Charles Dutton is in this, Mary Steenburgen, Stacy Keach, you know, all these people who we asked, well, you do want to be in this movie and get paid union minimum, and they said yes.
And is Stacy, I mean, I'm a huge Stacy Keach fan. I have to think Stacy Keach in the Ninth Configuration is just like one. I love him. Is he nice and wonderful, which I want him to be?
He was terrific. He came the night before.
Because obviously the part he's playing is not nice and wonderful.
Yeah, the night before he had been in Chicago playing King Lear on stage, and the next day he cut his hair and he was a redneck sheriff, and he was just a lot of fun to work with.
John, appreciate you coming in, and hopefully that distribution works well so everyone can go and see Honey Dripper. Appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's John Sayles.
I know.
Well, no, I was looking at you, but I was just saying for everyone that just joined.
Oh, I see.
That's John Sayles. Every time I look at you, I'm not necessarily talking to you. I might be saying, here's Nick with the travel.
How would you deal with that if somebody looked at you and said, that's what it is? You'd say, yeah, I know.
Yeah, I think I'd say that.
Thank you.
Aidan Short in Heaton Moor says, dear good doctors, before the arrival of our number one son, Joseph, he puts in brackets, hello, Joseph, my wife and I, also two doctors, would often go to our local cinema and see two films in one visit.
Oh, great.
We would try and see two contrasting films with a noodle-based meal in between. Always have to be a noodle. We had the kind of offer of a day's babysitting from my mum and dad, hello mum and dad, on Wednesday to set off for a double bill. So on the good doctor's recommendation, we saw Enchanted, followed by No Country for Old Men.
Okay.
Two excellent but certainly contrasting offerings. I was wondering if either of your good selves, or the listeners, key point, had any other suggestions for a double bill of similarly contrasting films. So we don't want kind of a couple of schlock films. We want nicely balanced films. Bearing in mind, says Aidan, with number two offspring on the way, it'll probably be sometime in 2013 when we get a day off to spend in such a manner, so we'll probably be watching Gandhi 2 against Transformers 11. Thank you, keep up the good work. So if there are any suggestions coming in, we will pass them on.
The Scala Cinema, formerly in King's Cross, no longer the Scala Cinema, now a club, I think, used to specifically do those double bills. For example, they would do Snow White and The Exorcist, and they would kind of invite the audience to draw comparisons between the demonic faces in both. And they used to do Dougal and the Blue Cat and Head. But the thing with Dougal and the Blue Cat and Head was there's no difference in them at all. They're both completely psychedelic movies made by people who are off their faces aren't they?
Let's not talk too much about Dougal and the Blue Cap. Yeah, well, you know, is it,
it's a sore point. I think you just saw a
clearly,
bad print of it.
Clearly not as good as you thought it was. Angus, very long email from Angus. But anyway, one of the points he ends up at is another example of people who've had long gaps between cinema visits. I don't know if anyone has topped this yet. He says, but my late grandma went to see The Sound of Music when it was originally released and didn't go back to the cinema until The Full Monty was re-released to celebrate an Oscar nomination at a gap, I believe, of 34 years. Keep up the wittertainment. My, there's a contrast there.
Yes.
Hasn't cinema changed?
It's a lot shorter, for one thing.
Top 10 at 10. Jannah Akbar.
Yes, which of course I haven't seen because it wasn't press screen, but I can tell you it's a 16th century love story which involved 80 elephants, 100 horses and 55 camels. And if anyone's seen it, please can text or email us a review.
Penelope at 9.
Which, again, I didn't like at all, but I now have it on absolutely firm authority from the 9-year-old girl contingent that it is a funny, witty, smart, enchanting movie about a woman, a young girl who has a pig on her face.
Definitely maybe at 8.
And definitely isn't the Annie Hall updating, which some critics have said it is. It's just one of those not going anywhere, haven't we seen this all before, rather innocuous, and then kind of quite cloying relationships movie, which has got this device of the father telling a story to his daughter and asking her to guess which one of the girlfriends that he's talking about is her mum. And every time you come back to that, you just think, oh, I'd forgotten that device, and I'm so troubled that you've just brought it up again, because I was kind of relaxing into the film.
Christian in South Sea, this is because at 7 there will be blood. Only at 7? Is that a...
Well, again, it's to do with how... No, it's to do with how wide it's being. I mean, there was a headline in Variety which was something like Oscar Big Fish are box office guppies. And what they were saying was that we're in an interesting period this year in which the really big hitters at the Oscars are not big money takers. And There Will Be Blood, for all its epic qualities, is not a huge mainstream movie.
Christian in South Sea on this email, while saying it's a great movie,
I love it. Oh,
very
course.
Good. Could you please explain to me and those less cine literate than yourself what you mean when you say it reinvents the language of cinema? Christian says, rather obsequiously, I've no doubt that you're right. I just don't know what you mean.
Yeah, no, I can explain it exactly. There are certain. You know, if you listen to the construction of a sentence, and people will say that the way in which somebody constructs a sentence is either modern or archaic. For example, if you said, forsooth, young lady walks here, so you say, OK, it's an old... And if you said, look, there's a babe walking over there, you'd say, it's a modern thing, right? Well, there is a certain grammar of cinema in the way in which scenes are put together, the way in which audiences expect a movie to pan out, which kind of becomes collectively the dialect of modern cinema. And the incredible thing about There Will Be Blood is... nothing about the way it was telling me the story told me where the story was going. So when I say it reinvented the grammar of modern cinema, what I meant was, even as somebody who for a living watches movies, and therefore you kind of you fall into the lilt of it. Or it's like when John Sayles was here, he's talking about blues riffs, you hear da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, you know we're starting on A, we're going to go up to D7th, fine. I had no idea an hour in where that film was going. It was like he was making up the rules as he went
along.
And
this is the film, of course, for a couple of weeks ago you suggested that you had to buy 5 seats, one for yourself and then one in front, one to the right, one to the left, one behind, so you can enjoy it properly. Sean in Bristol says, I saw There Will Be Blood last week. Fortunately, there was hardly anyone in the cinema, so didn't have to resort to Mark's 5-seat rule to enjoy the film. Maybe there's a particular category of film which should come under the 5-seat rule. Anyway,
yes.
Says, at the end of the film, I was left almost completely bewildered by the previous 2.5 hours. I'm not sure I liked it, although I think I did. But I knew I had just seen a work of genius.
Yeah.
Daniel Day-Lewis's performance is so immense. The landscape is so huge. And the symbolism so heavy that you find your senses somewhat numbed at the end of it. As Mark said, I'm going to have to see this film again to get to grips with it.
Well, that is almost exactly my reaction. I mean, the first time I saw it, I had exactly that thing. I know it's a work of art. I just don't know what work of art it is. And the second time round, it was like, OK, fine. No, this is really something. And the third time round, and I have now seen it 3 times, it was like... wow, we're off, you know, you're chained to a rocket and it's flying out of the, you know, it's on a whole, but it is that thing. I'll tell you, here's another comparison. It's like if you're a Westerner and you hear Eastern music for the first time, there's a whole idea that you listen to some forms of music on the left side of your brain and some forms of music on the right hand side of your brain. It's not until you've actually trained the right hand side of your brain to listen to the mathematical formulas of that you actually understand it. Well, it's like that with There Will Be Blood. It's like you don't get the tunes the first time. And the second time round you can hear an echo of them, and the third time round it's like it's hits on 45. You're there. That's what it's like.
Really?
No, I mean really.
But you don't want it to be hits like hits.
No,
on 45,
I don't. That was a crass thing to say, but I was going for a cheap
stuff that you
gag.
I realise what you're talking about.
The stuff that you recognise. Thank you. After that great thesis, it comes down to stuff that you recognise.
Essentially, yes. Rob, on this, the other night, Simon and Mark, a group of arty friends and I drunkenly got into a pointless argument about how one should correctly emphasise the title of Mr. Day-Lewis's latest film. Whilst Dr. Como tends to go for "There Will Be Blood," emphasising every word, we concluded that "There Will Be Blood" is more cynically affirmative. However, "There Will Be Blood" also seems to have merit in that it emphasises the dark nature of the chief protagonist. "There Will Be Blood" got one vote from a person that was especially incoherent and perhaps should be discounted.
But nothing for "There Will Be Blood."
No, but how would
Which was perhaps the most existential version. I thought that I was saying "there will be blood," as in... But the reason I say "there will be blood" like that is because it's biblical. I mean, it sounds biblical, doesn't it? I mean, it's not just me making it. It has a bit... Saying "there will be blood" sounds like a biblical... I mean, I'm even presuming, in fact, that it is biblical.
Do you know, it's a minute to the news and we're only on number seven. The bucket list at six.
You know, the kick the bucket list, the pass the bucket list. It's the latter for me.
Cloverfield at five.
Great big squishy alien that clearly saw the Bong Joon-ho movie. The host arrives in New York and bad stuff happens on a camcorder, but after you've spent 20 minutes in the company of those annoying young people, you're glad the monster's there.
Frankie Pigeon says, on the subject of the listener last week who had taken his 13-year-old to see the 15 Certificate Cloverfield, I say it's nice to see the tradition of experiencing films before you're really old enough is carrying on in this modern age. When I was 12, I really wanted to see the 15 Certificate Gremlins. Luckily, uncle with the gift of the gab took me and managed to talk the cinema staff that the 4-foot version of me had just turned 15. I wasn't so lucky 3 years later at the age of 15 when attempting to get into the 18 certificate Fatal Attraction with a group of friends. Some of them were younger than myself but all got in. My pleas of "you can phone my dad if you want" fell on the cinema manager's deaf ears.
My dad took me to see All the President's Men, which was a double A, when I was 12. He felt that it was a learning experience, and it was, and that's one of the fundamental things in my Richard Nixon "He's the Devil."
The Waterhorse, Legend of the Deep, starring David Morrissey at four.
Ever since my kids saw it, they've been walking around doing Brigadoon-like accents, and although they said, and he was the great, they said it's very sad but very, 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 very good fun. And I know it's all over the place, but I like, you know, David Morrissey is the stiff upper lip British soldier is, you know, is funny, but it is, it's a movie about the Loch Ness Monster that's explained in the trailer, you know, egg, toilet, loch. There, and that is fun.
Juno at three.
Loved it. I'd love to see Ellen Page win the Best Actress Oscar on Sunday night. I don't think it's impossible that it's going to happen. I mean, obviously, Julie Christie has been slightly derailed as the favourite since the surprise win for Marion Cotillard at the BAFTAs. So I think it's not impossible. And in fact, maybe if I can just will it into existence, Ellen Page. What are you laughing at?
I'm laughing at some of the double bill suggestions,
okay,
which have just arrived, for example.
Okay, I'll just carry on while read the mail.
Johnny Manchester. Das Boot with my left foot.
Very good.
Which works. And I also... An Airplane and Alive is being suggested by Andy. Those says you might have trouble with the noodles. So we have National Treasure Book of Secrets at two.
Wait, there's a new Indiana Jones movie coming out, or if you that won't do, there's all the old Indiana Jones movies on DVD, and there's Romancing the Stone on DVD. Why would you need to see National Treasure?
And the UK's number one is Jumper.
Hayden Christensen, he back with all the charismatic charm that he demonstrated in Revenge of the Sith. He shall always be that bloke who puts the bucket on his head and looks a little bit cross.
And Steve, final double bill before we will talk about the new releases, like Rambo, for example.
Yeah, you have to, because I've seen it now and I need to get it off my chest.
Contrasting double bills. Tarkovsky's Solaris with Shrek, Steve says, would be his ideal contrasting double
bill. When I saw Rambo at the beginning of it, there was a trailer for this movie coming up, Son of Rambo. This lovely little film about these kids that decide, and they had to spell it R-A-M-B-O-W for copyright reasons, but there's a trailer for Son of Rambo at the beginning and then Rambo, and I tell you, never was there more of a case of I wish I was in the trailer again.
Stuart in Lancashire says, discuss, why do I like listening to the film reviews when at the age of 49 I have never, and I mean never, seen a film as an adult? I don't believe such people exist. But anyway, Stuart says, I have no interest in films at all, yet I find this weekly spat amusing and somewhat entertaining. about someone who's never seen a film?
No, but they mean never in the cinema or never.
Never, and I mean never seen a film as an adult.
You'd have to work quite hard to never see a film as an adult. I mean, were you on planes or coaches or stuck in the living room or whatever, you're waiting? I mean, it's quite hard to never see a film.
It's actually a massive compliment he's paying you, though, isn't it? He enjoys that dynamic.
Yeah, but did you notice how he didn't take it like that?
I'm just intrigued, even though it's not interesting.
The yin and yang, that's what he really enjoys. The content is almost secondary.
Do you think there are people who listen religiously to the football commentary and listen to all the sport on a Saturday afternoon but just aren't interested in sport? See, I suspect there probably are.
Yes, wives, they're known as.
I suspect there are, just because they like the entertainment. Be interested to know.
No, I think you're being unduly modest, Simon.
Oh, shucks. Thanks, Philip. Lots and lots of emails about the U2 3D thing, and we'll talk about that again.
Yeah, we must do.
Particularly that Eva says, brilliant, love that conversation between Mark and the U2 woman. Haven't laughed so much in ages. And then disappointingly concludes, I'm with Mark, ghastly rock posturing.
Yeah.
Nick,
you're going to start me on this now. But
Nick, very much looking forward to Mark experiencing an epiphany reminiscent of Neil Young watching U2 3D. Then says, personally, I'm not a huge fan, but thought of Mark sitting through the film has cheered my day. Right, we need to talk about Rambo, yeah. Because all the posts... Actually, just
before
we do
that... I've seen Rambo, and I've been punched in the arm by... Chadders.
Yeah, by Benedict Cumberbatch, punch you in the arm because you were being rude about someone who's clearly a great actress, but you were always very rude about it and mispronounced her name for no reason.
But at least I'm, you know, upfront about it.
Tell us about Rambo.
So, there's a new Rambo movie. There was a... I mean, I've said this story before, but I was in Cannes for Radio 1 back in the late 1990s. And I was chasing around after Sylvester Stallone because I had to... Basically, the way it was going to work out was I either got an interview with Sylvester Stallone or there was no point in me coming back to England. And I spent the whole day doing this, and it was one of the most depressing days of my life. And I finally ended up getting, I think, 3.5 minutes with him in a hotel lobby before he got into his car to go back into Cannes for a bit. And what happened was he was there in Cannes with Copland, which was the movie in which Sylvester Stallone put all this other stuff behind him and stepped up to the mark as an actor, somebody who wasn't any longer an action hero. And Copland's actually a very interesting film. It is good, isn't it? I think it was even Radio 1 Movie of the Month.
It was a Movie of the Month, yes.
And it's a good piece of work, and Sylvester Stallone acquits himself very well, and it has references, for example, to It's a Wonderful Life. It has a thing about the damaged ear, the not hearing, the everyman character who takes upon him the sins, and all those sorts of stuff. And the thing that Sylvester Stallone said in the 4 minutes that I had with him, he said, look, I'm however old he was then, he said, and I'm just not going to do Rambo and Rocky anymore. I mean, it would just be stupid. I'm just not going to do that, right? And this was in my mind when, of course, we had the new Rocky movie, which was Rocky 98, whatever it was, just recently. You know, he said he wouldn't do it, and he did. And with the Rocky movie, it was like, yeah, he shouldn't, but the minute he got up there, and the whole point about the Rocky movie was he's too old to do the Rocky movie, right? He's too old, he can't do it, he's like a slab of meat, he's slow, he's lunking, and yet, when he got in the ring, you were with him, and when he started punching it out with the much, much younger guy, the underdog thing came back, and at the end, when they're running up the Philly steps, you go, yeah, I know he said he wouldn't, and I know he said he shouldn't, but hey, I'm kind of glad he did. I wish I could say the same about Rambo. So the story about Rambo is he's living out there in Thailand, and there is bad stuff happening in Burma. This is the political background. Bad stuff happening in Burma. A group of Christian missionaries want to go into Burma to take some medical supplies, but the really bad thing to do, because bad military stuff, if you go in there, really things are going to turn very bad indeed. Here's a clip.
Let go.
What are you doing?
We are so close. Wait, what happened here? It's horrible, but the people in there are being killed like this every day. Michael, this was your idea. We made a commitment.
I know you don't believe in what we're doing, but it's our life, our choice.
You're not going to change anything.
Please. Please, John.
Now, as I said, I learned some interesting things about the world situation from this, and one of them is that there are really bad people in the world doing really bad things, and the other is...
Particularly in Burma.
Yeah, and there are other things, which is there are some really nice people in the world, like Christians, and they're really nice, but the thing is that what they've got to learn is that until you've learned that it is okay to bash somebody's skull in with a rock, you really don't know anything at all. And that is the message of the movie. Now, in that kind of old 70s style, it's a revenge movie that spends its opening setting up a bunch of really really bad things in order that you may feel morally justified when some really bad things happen to the people that did the really bad things at the beginning. So the dynamic is, so it opens with what appears to be sort of real pictures of atrocities, whether they are in a cannibal Holocaust kind of styling. And then we have, he doesn't want to do that. He wants to just do some welding. He's doing a lot of welding at the beginning of this. But then these people come along and say, we want to leave. He said, you shouldn't go in there. It's really bad. But they want to. And then he says, oh, okay, because he kind of quite likes the girl. And then he goes, and then really bad stuff happens. And they get killed. And then he has to go in and do some really bad stuff to get the people back. And the body count apparently is 236. And the film is 91 minutes long. And look, I like, you know, films which have got things blowing up and stuff and action and all that kind of stuff. And I thought that this was not only a terribly bad piece of filmmaking, but a morally repugnant work. It's interesting that the BBFC in their, it's an 18 certificate, and you have to be quite tough to get an 18 certificate now, said, they say very specifically, they tell you all the things that happen in it, why it's an 18 certificate, like, you know, the sight of some Rambo tearing open a man's throat with his bare hands and and all that sort of stuff, blah, 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 blah. And then it says, bloodier scenes at the climax of the film also rely on the audience's desire to see retribution for deeds carried out earlier in the work, and this lends the film a sense of revenge that is most appropriately placed in the adult category. That is as close as the BBFC come nowadays to saying that the film is morally bankrupt, to saying that actually in those last scenes the whole thing has been constructed to make you enjoy the spectacle of violence. Now look, I'm not going to get moralistic about the spectacle of cinematic violence, because hey, you know, it's always been there, it's always going to be. What I really, really don't like is the kind of duplicitous fudging of the issue, the sanctimony, the sense of introducing themes of religion, introducing wider world, just all in the pursuit of carnage. Now, the film owes a visual debt, the worst kind of visual debt, to Saving Private Ryan, to that hideous shaky camera stuff really happening to people, you know, in war scenes. But the thing was, when Spielberg did that with Saving Private Ryan, what he meant was, look, you know, D-Day, not an action movie, really horrible, really genuine, terrifying thing. And in however many years it is, that whole thing has now turned into Rambo. It's just now another signifier of how action movie violence looks. And it's funny, because at the time, I remember somebody saying to me, the problem is, no matter how well somebody uses this technique, 5 minutes down the line, somebody will reproduce it without any of the moral backbone, and you'll wonder whether it was a good or a bad thing that we discovered this new level of realism. I mean, it's a film whose moral bankruptcy runs through it. So it is like watching somebody down on their knees saying, give me a pile of money and I will do absolutely anything. I have no moral fibre whatsoever. I have no narrative fibre whatsoever. I have no political understanding of the world whatsoever. I mean, I've read a couple of the reviews and they've said, well, you know what? It's meat and potatoes stuff. It does the thing, it gets in, it does the carnage, and then it gets out. I can't remember recently feeling quite so depressed about the way something. And all I could hear as this was going on was this conversation in what I thought was the worst day of my life in Cannes with Sylvester Stallone saying, I just wouldn't go back and do that stuff, it's stupid. And you know what? It's so much worse than stupid.
So we mentioned earlier when we were doing our U2 3D conversation, it was a double bandana day.
He's got the bandana on the whole time.
So you got Bono wearing the bandana, you got Rambo. I offer you tickets to go and see one of them again.
Yeah, I'm going to go to see U2. I'm going to sit in the middle. I'm going to have the volume turned up. I'm going to throw my hands up and say, you know, because Bono's wearing the bandana that says coexist, but it says it with religious symbols. Yeah. And, you know, Rambo is wearing the banner which effectively says insert money here. We'll work for millions.
Nick in London, who's the guy who...
It's horrible, Simon. Really horrible.
Is that a bad review then?
No, it is. I mean, I don't mean horrible in a good way. I mean horrible in a kind of...
So this is trying to help Nick. I read part of his email earlier, but he does conclude by saying, my girlfriend is away in South Africa. The experience has been extremely difficult in our relationship. I was wondering if the two of you could recommend a film which I could watch this weekend that would cheer me up. Given my current predicament, this means no romantic comedies and nothing overly depressing. I listen every week, would appreciate your counsel on this matter. This is a new role for us. So basically, Nick is missing his girlfriend. Is this the film?
No. Be Kind, Rewind is probably the film to do that for you.
Sid in Middlesbrough on the contrasting double bill thing, the greatest story ever told, followed by the life of Brian. Rambo and Dumbo.
But it's very good.
Works. And this from Martin in Manchester. My 60-year-old mum, a stepmom, beg your pardon, took me to see the very X-rated Don't
Don't Look Now,
when I was a tender...
On a double bill with the Wicker Man.
13 years old.
Wow.
I didn't look anything like 18, but my mum was so well respected in the town, the box office lady and the now defunct Harlow Odeon didn't dare challenge her bold assertions that I was older than I looked. Needless to say, I've been deeply in love with Judy Christie ever since. My inner 13-year-old will be rooting for her at the Oscars.
Absolutely. Can I just say one last word on the Rambo thing? When I said that the story is about a Christian who doesn't believe that you should keep it, learning that actually the way of the world is to bash someone's skull in with a rock, I don't mean that metaphorically. I mean that really. And when, I mean, that's what happens. And in those 70s revenge movies like Death Wish, people always said, oh, Death Wish was just the whole point about Death Wish, and in fact about the original Rambo, First Blood, was that there was nothing heroic about what was going on. In fact, it was a symptom of moral torpor. All you have here is no iron. It is good. That's it. The way of the world is this. And I kind of think, you know, we're so far into moral bankruptcy here that it's like, you know, mentioned Robert Johnson before. And how much would your soul cost, sir? That'll be $7.5 million.
So for Nick in London, who needs cheering up because his girlfriend's gone, he wants to go see something which isn't going to make him depressed, but he wants to see something rather charming.
Well, look, there's Whimsy, okay? There's Be Kind, Rewind, the new movie by Michel Gondry. Michel Gondry made Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is absolutely brilliant. You saw that, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes,
loved it. Based on a Kaufman script, and therefore a brilliantly written movie. Since then, he's done Science of Sleep, which he wrote himself and was far more impenetrable. Now, again, he's writing, but slightly back from the impenetrability. Story is there's a video store and two guys who kind of work in it, Jack Black and Mos Def, and they are left in charge of the video store. Jack Black, due to a complicated series of circumstances, becomes electrified and accidentally erases all the videotapes. So he and Mos Def then are left to re-record all the movies that were on those videotapes so that the shop can continue to function, starting with movies like Ghostbusters, which, armed with tinfoil and a camcorder, they go out and remake.
I'm Bill Murray. You're everybody else.
Are you crazy? She's never gonna buy it.
Yeah. She doesn't know what the movie's supposed to look like.
The only thing that she knows is what's on this box. She's never seen it before. If we stay 10 feet away from the camera, she's not gonna recognize us. We come up with some special effects, we do it ourselves. She's gonna be back in like 2 hours and 45 minutes. She's on the phone with Fletcher every night. The first scene is at the library. And action.
Start over. Sorry, cut.
What?
I looked right in the lens. We gotta start over.
You can't start over.
I look right in the lens.
You just have to do one good take, all right? Don't listen. What you're doing is good.
Just
do
this. Doing good, right?
Yeah, just do this.
Am I doing great?
You're doing great, but don't look at
it. You're doing good too.
All right, thanks,
with the cinematography.
Okay, good.
The process of doing... Am I open?
No, that's you.
The process of doing this is called Sweeding the movie. So these movies, they get a whole catalogue of movies what have been Sweeded, and they remake 2001 and they remake some Jackie Chan movies and they do that. And now, one of the... there was, I don't know where you saw, Jonathan Ross was on the film 2008, and he said that he thought the whole thing was just like watching a collection of YouTube videos. Now, as you know, I'm not very up on YouTube, so this may be true, but there is, I thought, a real charm in this process of, in this high-tech world in which we have CGI and mainstream, that what the thing with Michel Gondry, he has a real love of cinema, old school cinema, silent cinema. And if you look at his pop videos, for things, he used to be in a band called Lucas, and he did a brilliant video for Lucas with the Lid Off, which is all done in one shot, and it's all very old style music hall and incredibly inventive, and he does all his special effects in camera, meaning they're not done afterwards, they're done actually in the shoot. And that goes all the way through Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, in which the physical effects, like the scene in which he's under the table and Kate Winslet looks much larger than she actually is, and it's all to do with perspective shift, but it's done right there on screen, because this is the sort of the ne plus ultra of that. It's the let's take it as far as we can and remake these movies by literally having somebody with a camcorder and some tinfoil running around remaking them. And it has genuine charm. It doesn't, like all of Michel Gondry's self-penned works, have much structure, and there is a point after which you go, okay, I've got the gag, where are you going to go now? And then they introduce the spectre of DVD, and then it sort of a little bit runs out of steam, but it has enough whimsical charm to win me over. And as somebody who loves the fact that Michel Gondry loves cinema so much, and I mean hand cranked cinema, I mean physical cinema, I mean the actual thing of the film going through the lens, he loves all that stuff, and that for me comes through the movie. I think it's shambolic, I think it's undisciplined, and there's a thing at the end which says if you want to see all of the Sweden movies they made, you can go to an internet site, which I presume is connected to YouTube, which is exactly what Jonathan Ross is talking about. So as somebody who's not as high-tech as he is, hey, that wasn't something that bothered me. I think you have to have a quirk in order to enjoy it fully. I think it's much more easy to get into than The Science of Sleep, which was frankly impenetrable. It was like spending an hour, 2 hours in the head of Michel Gondry, which is a very strange place to spend those couple of hours.
Whimsy, you see, and whimsy being a great word, and just thinking about it, whimsy should be a separate category. And you go into your local DVD shop, there should be a section whimsy, because there would be like,
I agree.
I don't want meaning of life stuff. I don't want it. I just want
whimsy.
Yeah, and from the old English, whim wham.
Is that right?
Yes, meaning sudden notion, a fancy or an idea.
Is that right?
It is true.
Have you just looked that up?
I have just looked it up. Absolutely. Because I thought whimsy, what a great word. And there should be a category. So if you're feeling a little bit rough, and if your girlfriend's gone to South Africa and you don't want to be depressed and you don't want to see a movie where nine people get shot every minute.
Exactly.
Whimsy is what you
need.
9 yards
of whim wham. That's great. Do you know why butterflies are called butterflies? Because they used to be called flutterbys. They really did. And butterfly is an inversion of their proper name.
We need to be on for longer, don't we?
We do.
I'm sure.
Should we do YouTube? Because we've only got four and you've got so many emails.
Well,
go.
No, the thing is, we've done an awful lot on YouTube. What else needs to be mentioned?
Well, very quickly, I'll do this quick. Okay, My Blueberry Nights.
We do need to do that. And then if there's any time, we can do some more YouTube.
Okay, My Blueberry Nights, the new movie by Wong Kar-wai. I'm not going to play you a clip because we are short of time. But Wong Kar-wai is, you know, a great filmmaker, and he's done things like In the Mood for Love, which is a beautiful study of, you know, of unrequited, unphysicalized love. And he's a brilliant filmmaker. And with My Blueberry Nights, this played in Cannes last year, and it was that kind of thing about seeing somebody who has a great history of cinema suddenly making what looks like their first movie and making it really badly. And the story is Jude Law is kind of looking after this diner, and in comes Nora Jones, and she's a bit heartbroken, he's a bit heartbroken. And then there's this question about he's waiting for somebody, but she's looking for somebody. She goes off, she has some adventures, she teams up with Natalie Portman, she teams up with Rachel Weisz, she comes back, and then they have the conversation about what's it with the blueberry pie and why is there always blueberry pie left over in the diner afterwards. And it's to do with the fact that Jude Law loves the fact there's blueberry pie there even though nobody comes in and asks for it. And it's kind of all about love, because love is kind of like that, but it kind of isn't like that at all. And you're just going, what are you for? I mean, it's have you forgotten every film you've... I mean, he's made it in the English language, and it looks like a film that is classically lost in translation. It's shot by, I think it's Darius Conji shot it, and it's neon and stuff all over the place, and it's trying terribly hard to look American, and its choices of music are bad, and its choices of acting are not very good, and the script is all over the shop, and it's just... you know, a real disappointment. And I feel exactly the same way about it now as I did when it was at Cannes, which was everyone went, what? What happened? Did you fall off the medication? I mean, how did you make a movie this incompetent?
This is Mark, that Rambo review really cheered me up a horrible week. Thank you very much indeed. John in Spain. This is on the subject of U2 3D. We had a big conversation about this in our middle hour, because we had the director, Catherine Owens, on.
A very nice director.
And we think, you know, we could play you a clip, but frankly, there'd be
What's the point?
Because, you know, it's all U2.
Yeah.
Apart from that strange voice at the beginning saying, everyone.
Oh, yeah, what's all that about? That, my annoyance began.
Everyone. And then everyone. Then someone else says, everyone's thinking, what's this got to do with anything?
And it's like, because, Simon, we're all a bit, aren't we?
John on this says, does Mark remember the scene in Manhattan when Michael Murphy and Diane Keaton are discussing the Academy of the Overrated? If such a thing did exist,
it's long
been my view that you two would be founder members.
Yeah.
This from Tony.
She says Norman Mailer, and she nearly gets lamped.
I can't imagine a worse way to spend an afternoon than watching Bono emote in 3D.
Ugh.
Mind you, Mark is still wrong about Joy Division. Interesting question from Richard. Is U2 3D better than Jaws 3D?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the 3D is better. The thing is that this new 3D system does look very good. You don't get the headache. And it is a very good effect. You saw it on the IMAX, didn't you?
I saw it on the biggest screen in Europe or something, which is an extraordinary experience.
But it you do get the sense of the three-dimensionality of it. And the scene which, you know, passed me the vomit bag, when Bonio reaches out to the crowd, and he's playing to the camera. To me, it's like, put it away. You know, this kind of messianic nonsense is what really gets my goat. But at the same time, you're thinking, his hand really does look like it's coming out over the audience in a way that's more convincing than Udo Kier and the offal to which you referred in Flesh of Frankenstein.
Yeah,
but Flesh of Frankenstein has better dialogue.
There are very strange people. When the crowd stands up in front of you.
I want to stand up and look over them. Yeah, I of course was staying sat down because I'm not getting up for them. And there is also this thing about, you know, hey, we're with the crowd, we're with the audience, we're with them in as much as there are runways for us to run out onto. And my favourite moment was when the bassist runs out onto the runway, and the bassist, whose entire bass line is and Bonio says, "The genius." I'll be thinking, look, I'm a bassist and I'll take applause for bassists, but I'm sorry,
it's better than Rambo.
It is so much better than Rambo.
And the movie of the week,
well, Be Kind, Rewind, there's so much wrong with it, but it is still, of those ones, the movie of the week. I would love to have talked about Blackwater. We'll talk about it next week.
Downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live